Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
Books. Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gutenberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, my guest is Michelle Honovan. Her book is called Off Course, and it's published by Farrar, Straus and Giroux under the imprint of Sarah Crichton Books. And I got to tell you, I read it in 2 days, and it was such a read. It was so emotional. At first, I thought it was very, very sexy, and then I realized, oh, not everyone's going to get what they want. And it really put me in the human frame of mind where, yes, it is true, the wages of sin. You think that you're going to go off track, put aside your dissertation, fall in love with the perfect man, the most juicy man available, but he does not turn out to be a safe man. He's always juicing everywhere he looks. And then she finds another, and you think, oh, what a landscape, a place of paradise, you know, sex and then more sex. I just thought, what an incredibly pleasurable place to visit, until we realize that real life is going to visit, and it gets better still, because real life is better, even if it teaches you harsh lessons. Now, when you started this, Michelle, did you know that you were going to write something like an erotic fairy tale that would come crashing?
Well, I knew that there was a certain Edenic quality to it.
I'll say.
That they were going to be chased, you know, off the mountain, out of the garden. I did know that.
Uh-huh.
To some degree.
And this is in the California Sierras, yeah?
Yes.
Among some of the last privately owned redwood communities?
There are, yes, a few. I think even the last privately owned redwood stand has been taken over by conservation now, I'm happy to report. So just old growth redwood and beautiful, huge, tall ponderosa and lodgepole pines. And
now, you describe all sorts of plants seasonally, with their leaves loaded with snow and dripping as the snow melts, and in spring and summer and fall. Who gave you that gift?
Well, I did live for a while up in the Sierras, and I did go up there quite often with my family. There is an older gentleman who lived up there who used to say, you don't know a place until you've seen it through all the seasons. And I sort of took him at his word, and I made a study of it even when I was living up there.
Wow, because cress has come. She is not an English major, thank goodness. She's an economics major. She's working on her dissertation, and she doesn't like going to this A-frame in the mountains. She hated it when she was a kid. She wanted to stay at home with her high school friends for summers and get drunk and get laid and do all the other things that they were all doing. And instead, her mother made her come all the weekends to the A-frame, yeah?
Exactly. I mean, the mother had a bad experience as a young woman, and so she is so determined to protect her two children, her two daughters, that she really might just as well have given them a blueprint for disaster. I mean, that kind of overprotection almost guaranteed that her daughters would recreate her own sort of psychical landscape, I think.
And in addition, she named this daughter, the one who talks to us in this book, Cressida. And the reason is that her very best role, the mother had been an actress, had been in Shakespeare's play Troilus and Cressida, but Cress reads the play and finds out what?
Well, that Cressida is really not a stand-up kind of a gal. She flirts with the enemy. She sleeps with the enemy. Even by Shakespeare's time, the name Cressida was synonymous with prostitute.
And she, in fact, says to one of these men, "My mother might as well have named me the Great Whore of Babel."
Can you imagine?
Now she's an adult. She's got that inevitable, where do I write the dissertation? It's already overdue. She's tried to write it near Pasadena in Los Angeles. She's tried to write it here. She's tried to write it with an ex-boyfriend. This is the fate of dissertations. I mean, we all understand that that is a universal state. ABD, they call it, which stands for...
all but dissertation.
Yes. Have you been in that state?
I have not, but I did try for many years to write a first novel. So I had great sympathy with her inability to, you know, sit down and get to it.
And of course, when you are eager to stay away from the typewriter, you might be hot to trot. Other ways. And if you're there in this community full of mountain men who are, you know, there to service the tourists, if for lack of a better expression, who own lodges, and, you know, she's so much smarter. I mean, even the women refer to the other women who come for this special service as bims, and you know, she's smart.
Yeah,
she's smart. She's a pleasure to be with. She worms her way into a man's self-confidence and restores parts of it that are faulty. She is an emotionally compassionate character, and so we really like her. And we want her not to get hurt. We really do. We do feel, if we're adult, do your work. Oh, do your work. There's nothing more important. Were you rooting for her to do her work or for her to be in the arms of these guys?
Well, she has such an ambivalent relationship to her work by the time she comes up there. She's spent the past... you know, 3+ years in graduate school in economics, a highly sexist environment. There aren't very many women. The men were not interested in her, especially because she was performing quite well and publishing, you know, little essays and economic quarterlies and things. And she's sort of starved for male approval. She's really kind of... you know, vulnerable to it. And at the same time, she's got this big dissertation, this big job that she's got to address. She's just easily distractible. She's the kind of person who makes friends wherever she goes. And as she says at one point, being single on the mountain is, you know, sort of a public service, being a single woman.
Well, what's interesting to me is that the novel is really a wolf in sheep's clothing. We think of it as a novel of summer love and then of spring love and then of winter love and then of fall love. It's an idyll. But the wolf is waiting to pounce, and the wolf is learning to be an adult, learning to face adult responsibilities, being able to support yourself rather than supporting others emotionally, and that sometime you have to
step up. Yeah,
you have step up to the plate.
Yeah.
And why can't she?
Why can't she? Well, part of it is that she's just gotten in over her head. You know, it's sort of step by step. She has that first relationship with Jakey, the lodge owner. And she finds out, as you said, that he's just doing his thing all over the mountain, that she's not the only one. When she finds out the truth, it sets her free, and she thinks she's handled it quite quite well. She's quite proud of herself.
Oh, so the first phase is I didn't fall apart. I'm an adult.
I'm an adult. I'm strong. I can take on these slightly unconventional relationships, and I can hold fast to myself. And so when she gets involved with a man who's married, she has this kind of false confidence. And they get closer and closer. They get snowed in. They spend more and more time together. And they really get into dangerous emotional territory with each other.
I'm talking to Michelle Honovan about her novel, Off Course, which is really about something that happens to all of us after we go through that protracted period of education. The temptations of freedom are so great that we don't do what have you, the dissertation, the internship, the right thing. We stop doing the right thing. We need a little lapse. And then if that lapse becomes too wonderful, too satisfying, we lapse beyond reclamation. Yeah? And then the learning curve is very, very steep, because you can still become an adult, but you may never have it with the passion that you dreamed of.
Exactly. I mean, it's a little bit, they say that you shouldn't let yourself get too depressed because the body learns how to get depressed. And in the same sense, I think that you shouldn't get too lost, too far away from yourself into something like this kind of addictive, obsessive love, because it takes a toll. It permanently damages the psyche in a way that you never fully come back from.
In Off Course, there is, dare I call it, a symbolic bear. It's not just Goldilocks and the Three Bears. We think at first that the bear, with his rambunctiousness, his swarthy arms, stands for the man. He doesn't. He's on a rampage. He is the woman in the book trying to break into other lives because he can't find a life of his own. And because he's in the Sierras and it doesn't get all that cold, he doesn't even get the freedom to
hibernate, to get a good winter nap in. No, he's just always up and hungry.
Yes, this is a story as adorable as they get. But I had a friend whose children, Mommy, during hibernation, how does the bear go to the bathroom? So Mommy looked it up on the web. This is one thing where the web is for adults. And said, oh, well, you know, the solid waste becomes a plug and holds it in, and the urine stays in the body, and it turns into enzymes that keep the bear's muscles firm while the bear is asleep. But this bear, the bear in Off Course, is a wandering bear, and just like this woman, who has become, for herself, untethered without understanding that she's gone too far, and she has become depressed because the man she's fallen in love with is in fact a depressive, a lifelong depressive, who married his high school sweetheart, and he's been hiding behind a cheerleader, essentially, an absolutely spotless housekeeper who has nothing to communicate to him. So he meets our friend, the brilliant economist, and they see a vision of paradise together, but it requires that they both go deeper and deeper into a well.
And it requires isolation, because the truth of the matter is he has his own family, he has obligations, he has children, he has a mother, he has a brother and a sister-in-law. He's part of a community. You know, they belong to this small town. And she is somewhat cut off, too, living in this cabin away from her friends. And the second they try to integrate some of that is where life begins to intrude, of course.
And sleeping with the local rascal who's single and, you know, everyone wants him to settle down, and maybe this will work out. You know, it's an interesting match. Yes, okay, good. But sleeping with another woman's husband, people don't have the approval or enthusiasm for it. And she's treated to ostracism and to, a group of women join in their church to pray her off the mountain. And it really is the sense, here we are again, of a woman who doesn't fit into the economics department.
Notice that they're not praying him out of town or off the mountain. They're praying her out. There's a double standard in the treatment between the actual adulterer, the person who's committing the adultery, and the outsider. The outsider gets it a lot worse than the adulterer does.
It also speaks of how base we tend to think men are, that they can't help themselves, that they're animals, whereas the women should be able to.
I think so, yeah.
Are they? Do you think they are? I mean, I'm a man. I can't help myself.
I don't know. I mean, it's something that I kind of thought about a lot when I was writing the book, which was, poor Cress really gets a lot of disapproval and suffers a lot at the hands of her friends because she's made this choice. And I think that there is something kind of wrong with her, that she doesn't feel more guilty about it. But that's her own makeup. I mean, I think in order to get so involved, she has to have this kind of blank spot that she talks about, where she knows she should feel something. She knows she should feel more remorse, or she should feel more concerned about the pain that she's creating. But she's incapable of finding that compassion inside of her because something else is driving her. And one of the things that's driving her, I think, is just the kind of compulsion that is imprinted on her from her mother, the kind of family, what do you call it, a family romance, just that simple family romance of wanting affection from the father so badly. She's so driven by these unconscious motives, you know, the same things that, you know, are sort of making her a marauding bear.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Michelle Hunnevin about her book, Off Course. We'll continue after this short break.
I'm Connie Alvarez, producer of Bookworm. Check out our other KCRW programs in the podcast section of iTunes. Shows like DNA, Good Food, The Treatment, Unfictional, and The Business. Or listen on KCRW's smartphone apps. And thanks.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, this is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Michelle Hunnevin about her latest novel, Off Course, a book that emotes beautifully in the telling of complex relationships from child to parent, from woman to lover. Now, that is one thing that is absolutely true. She may be having a fling with Jakey, but she is having a love affair with Quinn. And they are having a love affair with one another. And in this case, they're neither of them... they're neither of them bad people. They've just fallen into the pit of too much understanding and valuing perception, deep perception, over the progress of life. And it's hard. You really convinced me of the progress from love to suffering in this book. You took me a place I didn't expect to go.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I forgive you.
Well, I did want to write about, you know, how love can go off or become, you know, completely obsessive and a compulsion, that when it becomes intermittent, there's nothing as addictive as sort of intermittent affection, intermittent attention. And Cress is starved for it, and she's set up for it. And like any other form of addiction, the addiction turns your perceptions on their head. And at a certain point, you know, she's convinced, and this is way down the road, that she can't live without this man, that life will be meaningless without him, that she can't survive without him, that everything will be empty and sere and depleted without him. But the truth of the matter is, the opposite is true.
Now, I know why the food is so good in this book. You used to be a food critic. And I know why the nature is so splendidly described. You lived up there in the Sierras, and after all, you're a writer. But will you dare to tell me why the understanding of hopeless love is so good?
Well, I think that don't we all have some understanding of that at some point in our life?
I think we all do, but nevertheless, the living with it for the time it takes to understand a character deeply and write a novel, I think it has to be like you're volunteering to understand it for sure and for all time. Did you ever make a mistake?
Of course. I made several in my life. I was sort of set up for that kind of obsessive love emotionally, and so I'm acquainted with it. And it was interesting to write a book about it and go back, and a book takes years, and love affairs take years. And I always thought that those particular love affairs were the lost years of my life. And yet, to me, they sort of yielded one of the better products of my avocation.
Do those kinds of obsessive love happen more than once?
Oh, I think they can.
Yeah. It's very interesting to me, because someone who'd also read the book said to me, well, Michael, you understand, men really enjoy reading this book. Women find it painful because it cuts close to the bone of what happens when you surrender your life to anything outside yourself. When you're blown off course, the retrieval is very, very hard to find. I mean, you know, this character literally comes to an understanding that she has to settle for less if ever she's going to get her life back.
Exactly.
Wow, is that really? I mean,
but I think, as she says at one point, she says that once you make a decision, you close off a lot of possibilities, but then a lot of new options come forward. I think to some degree, she finally begins to face some of the new options, but she's not going to go into it with that kind of unconscious joy, that kind of romance, that kind of, you know, just miasmic happiness or something. That's just not going to happen again. But I do think that that's just growing up. I actually don't believe deeply in the powers of romantic love. I think it's wonderful while you're in it, but sooner or later, you're going to notice that there's, you know, socks on the floor, and he never puts the bath mat, you know, the wet bath mat over the rod. You know, reality does intrude, and I'm not sure that kind of wonderful snowed-in romance that they had is sustainable.
Well, I have a final question. Much of this, the writing of the dissertation, the distraction of falling in love, are qualities that are true of writing a novel as well. I remember that Cynthia Ozick was asked about her career coming to her late. And she said, well, no, I wrote a very long novel, Trust. It was hundreds and hundreds of pages long. No one read it. And I suffered. I can never get that back. I can never have the joy in my career I would have had if my first novel had been a barn buster. And I think many of us do get what we want in life, but not at that level of childish rapture.
Right.
That's what we lose.
Right. And to tell the truth, in writing my very first novel, Round Rock, there was such a joy and an ease in it, and there was no deadline, and I took as long as I wanted, and that's never been recaptured. Uh-huh. Now I think so much more about what I'm doing.
Well, I will tell you this, Michelle. This book reads with such ease and flow. It's so easy to spend hour after hour with it. Another person in my life said it's a read by the fire kind of novel. And it really is. It has a great storytelling rapture that I have to commend. Thank you.
Thank you, Michael, so much.
I've been talking with Michelle Honovan, author of Off Course, published by Sarah Crichton Books of Farrar, Straus & Giroux. You can comment on today's show or read an excerpt from Off Course at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW smartphone apps. My co-producer is Connie Alvarez. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Special thanks to Jane Parshall. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm when Dustin Long is our guest.
Tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.